read to him the 29th scroll. 6th verse.
Beware the beast man, for he is the devil's pawn. Alone among God's primates, he kills for sport or lust or greed. Yea, he will murder his brother to possess his brother's land. Let him not breed in great numbers, for he will make a desert of his home and yours. Shun him, drive him back into his jungle lair, for he is the harbinger of death.
Welcome to the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, Planet of the Apes Retrospective Series.
My friends, I have convened this extraordinary meeting of the Council in order that I may report upon an action which I deemed necessary.
Join Matt.
You are a good and wise ape.
Garrett.
The human way is violence and death.
And Adam.
The only thing they fear more than me is you apes.
As they travel through the spectrum of Earth and into the Forbidden Zone, and consequently dissect the most primitive of all film franchises.
My God, did we finally do it?
From the Charlton Heston starring 1968 original,
take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape!
To director Tim Burton's 2001 remake,
we've been searching for you for so long.
All the way through the latest entry, 2024's Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
I don't believe it!
The man will see, the man will do, their opinions of how good or inferior each movie in the series truly is.
He has a definite gift for mimicry.
All coming up, courtesy of Percolated Media.
All of human history has led to this moment.
Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Released August 5th, 2011, budget was $93 million, with a box office take of $481 million.
Wow.
This was directed by Rupert Wyatt. So I guess we should call this the dawn of the Planet of the Apes, because this is the first of a second attempt at rebooting a beloved franchise. This is Goudreau here. Welcome back for part 2B of our return to Planet of the Apes. Last week, we talked about Tim Burton's attempt to revitalize the franchise. And as we'll get into, and we kind of teased this last week, any plans for that part to continue went down in flames.
That thing came and went, and it, like we mentioned last week, it made a ton of money. It made a lot of money, but nobody was wanting to see that story continue. Nobody was wanting to go from where they left off. I was the one who thought the ending was fun. Actually, me and Adam both thought that the ending last week was fun, but the whole hour and 50 minutes or so before that was just atrocious. So, yeah, let's once again swig, rinse, spit out, and let's start all over. And when it comes to Planet of the Apes, they've done it once, they've done it twice. Can they do it a third time? Can they start a whole new universe with these apes the third time? That was the big question.
So, yeah, let's talk about how we got to this point. As indicated, Fox wanted a sequel to Tim Burton's film. As you mentioned, it did succeed at the box office, but the 1-2 punch of Burton just being burned out by that production, and the film, while doing well, just not garnering enough general interest to warrant another film, it basically was cast aside and all subsequent plans were canceled, and it remained dormant for about a couple years. So it didn't sit on the shelf too long as far as Planet of the Apes itself. Because around 2005 was when they first started conversations about doing a new film, specifically a film that would eventually become Rise of the Planet of the Apes. But it was not part of Tim Burton's canon. It was not going to be a sequel to the pre-established five-film franchise. This was very much it's conceived as a new thing. Speaking of new, let's talk about the writing team they brought in, because it's kind of interesting. They brought in, much like they did on the fifth one, they brought in a husband and wife team, Rick Jaffa and Amanda Silver, who had been writing together since the early 90s. Look at their
history. Yeah, in fact, Adam, you and I are, we were at the time big fans of their first film that Amanda Silver ever wrote. She wrote The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. That was her script. She's been around. She's done some different things, but they, when they became a husband and wife team, like they did some pretty good to okay to not so great things. And in fact, they are co-writers of the three Avatar sequels that we're going to be getting. So they've carved quite a career for themselves.
They have, and they were co-writers on The Way of Water, so they are. We talked about them previously, but up until Planet of the Apes, they had not done anything in the vein of gigantic spectacle. They had done Hand That Rocks the Cradle, but that's a small, intimate type of thriller. They had done Eye for an Eye with Sally Field.
Oof.
Not a great movie by any stretch. In fact, it's downright awful, if you ask me.
It's pretty bad. And then they did The Relic, too, which is another just bad movie with Penelope Ann Miller. I tried rewatching it probably about 2-3 years ago. It is unwatchable. It's a really bad film.
So nothing in their pedigree sort of dictates that they're the right people to take on this franchise, but what happened was they pitched an idea about, inspired by news articles that talked about apes being raised as humans in human households, and, you know, genetics have come a long way in the decades that have followed the 70s, so what was once seen as farcical and unrealistic morphed into something that was sort of a modern take on Planet of the Apes, where It's really not that far out of the realm of possibility when you, I mean, there's absurdist elements that are just natural with this property, but what happened was they said, let's do this to reboot the franchise, reuse the character of Caesar, kind of talk about how, really very much, this is sort of the Batman Begins Casino Royale model. We're revitalizing a franchise, very much its own thing, but if you want to read it as canon, you can sort of look at it as a prequel.
Yeah, Batman Begins and Casino Royale definitely were on my mind as I was watching this again.
Fox, surprisingly, liked the pitch, because normally if you look at what they did with the X-Men franchise in the mid-2000s, they greenlit basically everything as long as it would make money.
Yeah.
But then it sat on the shelf for 5 years. They couldn't get a director. They couldn't get producers on this. They had the idea, and that was it. So what happened was around 2010, there were a couple of producers from Chernin Entertainment. They said, well, put some money into this, and they retained Jaffa and Silver as writers. So they were carried over for pretty much the entirety of this production. And then they brought in Rupert Wyatt, the director, who we have not talked about, because he's only done, before this, he'd only done one film, The Escapist.
The Escapist, which was a Sundance, it was a Sundance darling. You know, he got a lot of notice for that. I remember the talk about it when it was out. And it also had Seamus in it, of all people. Like, he was a big part of it. And Conor McGregor actually had a bit role in it, too. He had, like, I think he was an extra or something in it. So, in looking at it, I only watched it once. I watched it about 15 years ago. It's okay. But I could definitely see the seeds that they were going for when they hired this guy. Or, and if I were looking at it from a pessimistic point of view, they got him for very cheap.
I think a little column A, a little column B.
This is very much starting the trend of, and other properties have done this in the years since, of taking a director who got their name out there for a small independent film, and then they're given millions of dollars to do these blockbusters. Look at the Colin Trevorrows. Look at Gareth Edwards, look at Jordan Vogt Roberts, whatever, the guys of Kong Skull Island. This is nothing new. But when they hired him, he said, it's not a continuation of the other films. It's not. It's an original story. It's going to satisfy the people who enjoy those films. But he directly referenced Batman Begins. He said he wanted to bring the fan base into that film exactly like Nolan did. And as he was doing press, he said, yeah, we are incorporating elements from mostly Conquest, but this is primarily like a prequel if you want to look at it in that sense. So it's not hard canon, but they left the door open if you're someone who likes to think in that context.
I think you could find ways to definitely tie it in, and if you're not going to look at it as a direct sequel prequel, you can at least find homages just littered throughout. You could tell they at least did their homework and had watched the films that had come before, because there's bits of all of them strewn throughout.
This is the beauty of doing our show in this format. You see the evolution of where this franchise came from. But 2011, I teased this at the end of the last show. I had no expectations for this at all. I still had sort of a bad taste in my mouth because when I think of Planet of the Apes, I thought of the Tim Burton movie at this point. I was kind of not sure the direction they were taking. I had questions about this director. I had never heard of him. And that summer, it was basically the Russian roulette of walking into a movie theater where he said, yes. You had no frickin' idea that summer what you were walking into. You had Harry Potter, you had Transformers, you had Pirates of the Caribbean, and Fast Five, you had X-Men First Class, so another reboot, Green Lantern,
yeah.
Captain America, like, it was a crowded summer, but quality was, you know, had ebbs and flows every week.
Summer of 2011 was a really bad summer for me. I was on the tail end of a really bad relationship, and I was just starting to find my feet when it comes to online reporting and stuff. And a friend of ours, Super Marcy, gave me a couple reviewing gigs over there, and I was on their podcast a couple times. And I think Amigos was starting up the next year. But I literally wasn't sure exactly what to do. And then I landed on this site where he actually sent me to review this. And I hadn't seen, like you, Matt, all I thought of was the Burton film because I hadn't seen any of the other ones. So I went pretty cold. And from what I remember, I think I gave it an okay review. I think I gave it a somewhat positive review, but not overly positive. And from what I remember, the reception of this was huge. Like, people really, really dug this movie, and I thought it was okay. So in revisiting this and not going, the summer of 2011, I mean, I was at the movies every goddamn week, you know, trying to escape where I was. And so if I wasn't in an escapist mode, how was I going to feel coming into Rise of the Planet of the Apes this time? That was my question going in.
Scale of 1 to 10, Adam, what did you expect or your level of interest going into this?
When I saw it originally, I had almost no real I had an interest only because of, hey, this looks like it's updated and modern, and it's set where I live here in the San Francisco area. My wife seen a lot of movies, so it was something fun that we could do together, but that Burton film had left a bad taste in my mouth. So that part of it, I really had some trepidation about. I'd been burned on Apes, and I didn't have the love for the originals, hadn't seen them, you know, now I have, and it's amazing how much I could admire them, but it was just, it's a movie, let's go check it out. And that's about all that it was for me.
Yeah, because a lot of the hype going into this wasn't really about the story as much as, and I'm sure, Matt, you're going to talk about this, but the way the apes came to life this time, they weren't using suits this time. They were going to Weta Digital. And that was the big hype, was the stars of this aren't going to be in suits. They're going to be computer animated.
Mocap apes.
And that was actually something that was a point of contention when the movie was being made. They made the conscious decision to say, let's not do people in suits. And technology has advanced far enough to where we can digitally create them primarily through performance capture, not just digital effects where we're actually going to take the actors and replicate their movements. But the breakthrough was really, it allowed them to, this is the benefit of performance capture, you can shoot on location. Not like you had to do back in the old days where they're in a padded room, you capture their stuff and you reinsert it. But they did say that one of the challenges was going to be for the third act of this movie when you have just so many apes. You can only capture six actors at a time. So how are you going to do that? So then there are certain shots where they're almost entirely digital when you look at the backgrounds. But the effects were really something that were being hyped up when this was coming out. People were saying, you know, this looks really cool. It's different. But, you know, this year, like, you look at the amount of money they spent on Green Lantern and for those effects to be so subpar. Transformers look good. X-Men First Class has some really inconsistent effects. But the most shocking thing in context is when you look at this, a summer blockbuster made for under $100 million. Like, they did not overinflate this budget, and it made almost $500 million, which was, I think, a surprise to even the studio.
In 2011, like, it's weird. This film sometimes feels like it, you know, when I'm looking at it, getting ready to watch it, I feel like it was 20 years ago that it happened. And it's not. It was only a little over a decade. And, yeah, that's actually an amazingly cheap budget for something that has this much going on and this much, as much as it may not be newer technology, it had drastically evolved and improved that technology from what Weta had done on Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, and I would imagine when this thing was starting to get developed in 2005. I mean, that was 2 years removed from Return of the King. So, Matt, I mean, you're saying they thought about doing Suits and Things right after, even though that movie had come out, and the start of this movie also kind of revolutionized the motion capture in that one as well. They had no inkling of doing Apes digitally until later. That's what you're saying?
Basically, yeah. It sounds like there was never a point where they were going to be people in prosthetics. I mean, but think about it, you know, look at the comparable things around this time. You had X-Men, where Beast was, they went from makeup in X-Men 3 to they did him CG in First Class. Mm-hmm. You look at some of the other stuff that was happening. I mean, look, everything in Green Lantern looks like shit. But, you know, most of the Captain America enhancements were done computer-wise. So it's just the way the industry was going. Yeah, I mean, the movie came out, it got strong word of mouth. I think that certainly helped get the box office take to what it was. And it started a new franchise. You know, we have three movies in this series to talk about. And then we have this new one, which is tied, but also not a direct sequel per se.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I don't know if they had any inklings of actually any intention of doing a whole set of movies. Like, did they make this movie thinking that it was going to launch a franchise? Like, they've done so many times. You know, how many times have we seen it where they do first movies that are there not just as standalones, but they're there to start a franchise? I get the feeling in watching this, they didn't really have that in mind. And I know the box office takes surprised them, but I don't know if I know exactly how much it surprised them, because this thing, as you said, made $500 million. And I don't know, were they intending on making this a whole new franchise?
So when the movie came out, the director did say, we're ending with questions, and he said, this is just the beginning. So it sounds like their intent was to make sequels. But look, the movie has a post-credits scene that basically sets up what's to come, among other things. But let's get into the movie, since there's a great deal of conversation to be had. So the movie gave me pause right at the beginning as it starts, not because of anything that the movie did through no fault of its own, but having just seen Madame Web starting out in the jungle in a studio movie kind of sets me off on a bad note nowadays.
Yeah, you also had Predator as well. The last time I seen this movie was Weekend it had come out, so I literally remembered almost nothing about this movie. I did not remember it starting in a jungle and having all these effects, like, you know, the beginning of one of the Transformers films or something, you know, where you have all these effects kind of roaming around, and I did not remember it this way.
The beginning completely caught me off guard. I didn't remember anything about this beginning.
The movie starts off, you know, this is a Planet of the Apes movie, but because it's a prequel, we're not starting in, you know, ape-dominated suburban San Francisco. We are starting in the jungle, where we're seeing some apes sense of foreboding, where the birds are flying away to signify danger. We see some humans, and we do see some of the apes get captured. So not necessarily directly following expectations, certainly.
I thought this was well done. I think if you're going to redo a franchise like this, you gotta keep people a little off guard. And there's going to be times when this movie does kind of preach to us. And that was definitely really prevalent in the 70s. But in this opening scene, we are really getting a taste of how Wyatt is going to stage these scenes and make it so that it actually impressed me. And, you know, another thing that impressed me, too, was that you kind of have to start with a scene like this, because I think they wanted to show right off the bat that the effects in this are going to blow your mind. And you know, 13 years later, they hold up okay, but there are still some herky-jerky motions and things in it that don't really look that great. There are times in the middle of the movie where it went in the facility and they show him jumping up on a tree in the facility. It does not look good at all. Here, I think it looks pretty good. It's getting us off on a really good note.
It's definitely one of those movies where the technology on display is sort of the, I don't want to call it the gimmick, but it was a selling point. These apes look about as good as you could get at the time. As you indicated, there are some fluidity issues when you look at the rendering and the conversion of human movement, but you look at the decade prior was Gollum, and that still looks pretty good, but there is a substantial leap between what Gollum looks like versus this, and Jar Jar Binks for that matter. So it's a pretty impressive technical exercise, again, for a movie that was made under $100 million.
Once you're messing with hair, fur, and getting that, I mean, you're no longer dealing with just cel-shading clothes and made-up skin tones. So, you know, when you think of something like Monsters, Inc. as well, just the animation that goes into the hair is superb.
Yeah, it's always one of the very, very few animators like doing hair and fabric.
Yes.
Fine.
Oh my God.
The one who does, and most likely their notes will be written on a piece of toilet paper at an insane asylum.
I tell you what looks pretty good is the when they show Caesar as a baby, because don't forget, we were, what, a year away from Breaking Dawn with that horrible CGI baby?
That was this year.
Was this the same year? Okay.
Part one came out that fall.
All right. I think the Caesar baby looks a little better than the baby in that.
We see the ape get captured, and we then cut to San Francisco, where we're introduced to Will Rodman, played by James Franco. Now, let's talk about this casting, because originally this role was written for Tobey Maguire.
Oh, my God.
He did not want to do it, because Tobey is notoriously kind of an asshole.
Yeah, he's so fucking selective.
Nobody
to the point where he doesn't even do anything.
Nobody wants to acknowledge that. So, I guess Fox had Spider-Man on the mind, because then they called James Franco, who was also in the Spider-Man movies with Tobey Maguire. And, you know, I think Franco's okay, but he's one of those actors to where I think he works much better in smaller movies than he does these big scale ones, because he's good at intimacy and character work, but I don't think he has 100% of the commanding charisma needed to carry a movie of this sort. And we learned that the hard way with his Wizard of Oz movie.
Oh, God. I forgot about that one. Yeah. You know, I think he's pretty good here. He's actually better than I remembered. I said at the end of the show last week, all I remembered really is that he walked around looking really high the entire movie. I think he's better than I gave him credit for. I think we lost something when he just kind of went off and did all these little freaking comedies, and he went off and hung out with Seth Rogen and all these fuckers. I think he's decent. Now, he's not great. I think there's definitely people who could emote a little better, but I have no issues liking him in this movie. I think he's pretty good.
Yeah, I think he does a good job. I think the issue is he's never going to be a star. He's never going to be your leading man star. Like, he's not going to sell a film, but he's not going to detract from it. My issue, though, after about the first half hour of this film, I feel like I'm seeing Norman Osborn throughout the rest of the course of this film. Like, you might as well put Oscorp up on the building as we get into the bio parts of this film. And I can't get that out of my head.
No, it doesn't help that it's a green gas, too.
It's a green gas. He's wearing the same outfits, and he's got the same look on his face. But he's bringing something different, but not different enough. But he does a good job. I just think I think he could be an amazing character actor when he does those pieces, but trying to make him as the lead, where the lead in this film is Andy Serkis, is, that's just where it's not perfect, but I don't think he's bad by any means. Like, I think he does a solid job, to Gary's point.
No, and I came to his defense when this movie came out, because it was sort of that was the one knock a lot of people had. But having said that, this is not a Mark Wahlberg situation where I think he's just miscast and looks bewildered. I think he understands the movie he's in, and he's actually one of the few people, and I'll give him credit for this, because he had done the Spider-Man movies, he knows how to respond to visual effects.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Especially acting against it. Look at more so 2 and 3, because the first one, he doesn't really interact with a lot of computer effects. But he's a pharmaceutical chemist where he's testing a drug, ALZ-112, so they're trying to find a cure for Alzheimer's, and I'm pretty sure I saw this movie, but it involved sharks in 1999, It starred Samuel L.
I thought of Deep Blue Sea as well.
I mean, it's inescapable, because although I will say the science of this movie is a lot more plausible than anything you see in Deep Blue Sea, where it's like, we fed the sharks like growth hormone so their brains grew. We didn't realize they were going to get bigger too. I'm like, do you not understand like how physiology works? So he's advocating for this very hard, as we'll find out, because his father is suffering from Alzheimer's, so he does have the personal connection. And this is something that I think makes this movie kind of stand out, is that there is a real, you know, in a movie about apes, there is a human connection and a human story to propel this beyond just a dumb summer blockbuster.
I remember Lithgow being in this. What I don't remember, Lithgow's pretty damn great in the parts that he is. Like, he sells the human element that you really feel what's going on here. As anybody who's ever dealt with dementia, loss of mind, Alzheimer's, an aged parent, or having to be a caregiver, like, holy crap, this really just brings some emotion to it. And I think that differentiates this from the other Apes films, is there is a human focus that we never had to worry about on the other ones.
And the human focus is prevalent enough to where you're not sitting there going, okay, get back to the apes. It doesn't have that problem.
Yeah, the human emotion, the human drama works really well in this, and I didn't remember it like that, actually. I remember feeling when I was in theaters that the human stuff didn't work. I remember thinking it didn't resonate. But maybe, boys, maybe that has something to do with the fact that we have gone through this series movie by movie, and I am seeing kind of the beats that they do. And this movie does go off it a bit, but I gotta tell you, it still hits those beats that we saw previously. It's just in a more modern way, which is what a good remake does. And I'm feeling it in these opening moments.
Because they can't get human trials cleared just yet, they decide to test it on one of the chimpanzees they captured, named Bright Eyes, which is a reference. This movie's got a ton of references, and it helps having seen all these movies in rapid succession, because I caught them in a way that I would not have, and I don't believe I did, back in 2011.
Right there with you.
Yeah, definitely. And as I was thankful that we had gone through these together, because, yeah, I caught them too, and I was looking, Adam's made this reference 100 times, but I was looking like DiCaprio in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, just pointing at the screen, going, oh, I remember that. You definitely catch yourself thinking about those things when you're watching this. Is, yeah, we've seen this before, but this is done in a way to tribute it and to tell its own story.
I appreciate it, because a little thing like that with the Bright Eyes, if you know it, it's like, oh, that's nice. And if you don't, it doesn't matter. You know, it's not so in your face that it takes you out of the moment.
No, this is not the J.J. Abrams method of, hey, remember this?
Yeah.
We're just going to linger on it for 20 seconds. Which is about as much screen time as Bright Eyes gets, because while her intelligence does increase, so the drug has some steady progress, she's forced from the cage and sort of goes on a rampage. Doesn't directly kill anybody, but they do decide to euthanize her and sort of terminate the project.
Yeah, this is devastating. This is just a devastating scene. And you definitely feel the pain that Will's going through. Like, oh my God, my father is going through this. This is my only chance. And now it's going to go away. So they are really setting up what he's going to do, why he's going to do it, and kind of make you in kind of a moral pinch when he is going through with what his plan is.
Yeah, and pretty good action scene with this chimp going through it too. Within the last year, if anybody had watched Fall of the House of Usher, there's a one of the episodes, there's a chimpanzee, you know, kind of like action attack scene. And it doesn't look too far removed from this, you know, even though it's been over a decade. This actually looks good while it's going on.
I was thinking of the opening of Nope.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Although it's not that degree of horrifying, although it still works, because this movie is PG-13. And it's, you know, it's got some hard stuff in it, but I didn't feel like this is one of those movies where we really wanted it to be rated R, but we also wanted to make money, so let's just make it PG-13 to play it safe.
No, this feels like a natural. This feels like a natural PG-13. This isn't one that the studio was like, okay, you got to pinch this down. Everything that happens in this, yeah, the intensity in this is big. You know, I didn't remember the intensity as much as there is in this, and yeah, it earns that PG-13 rating. But I like the fact that we're not at R too.
So while Will's kind of rightfully downtrodden about what's happened, his assistant comes in and tells him that Bright Eyes went off the beaten path because she had just given birth, and Will realizes that the infant chimp is still alive and reluctantly chooses to adopt him in a, you know, in a literal sense, and gives him the name Caesar.
Yep, and again, I mean, this is an obvious reference here, right? We were obviously referencing those previous films. But it also plays a big part in what this character's arc ends up being in this movie. It's a good tribute and also a good way of setting up exactly what this character is going to go through.
Yeah, and they could have went a different way. They could have decided they were not going to use those same names and do something different, and it would have been all right. But going with Caesar, and as you said, it's a natural evolution of the Caesar as a character throughout the course of this film, at least. And yeah, it seems fitting. And I do remember, it is crazy because California's had so many funky laws when it comes to exotic animals. And that was news stories in the years previous to this. I mean, growing up, we had an alligator in my house when I was a kid.
I remember.
Wally Gator. Yeah. So it's funny that this, how, you know, close this hits to home, because California, for all its issues and wonderfulness and problems, exotic animals has always been one of those funky things, because they allow them until they ban them all.
And all things being as they are, a chimpanzee is really not the craziest thing. I mean, maybe a little more maintenance you'd think than a cat or a dog, but it's not that far off the, you know, the exotic trail.
It's not like
you'd have Arnold, a lot of shit thrown at you, though.
Not like Arnold getting his ferrets taken away.
And let's not forget, Clint Eastwood also carried around a chimp for, what, 2 films? A couple decades prior.
Yeah, most of his co-stars.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah, anyone who has human kids knows there's plenty of shit to go around, so don't worry about it. So he realizes that Caesar has been affected by the drug through, you know, maternal exposure. We do see that baby, as you allude to. Yeah, it does look better than what we saw at the end of Twilight.
Yes.
Then we cut to 3 years later, so a little bit of a time jump where we see Caesar is relatively well-adjusted. You know, he's intelligent, he can move around, but he can't speak yet, so we're not at that point just yet, but he is able to communicate pretty extensively through sign language, and this is where star of the film, Andy Serkis, sort of comes into frame. And let's talk about Serkis, and we'll do that 3 times this year, because we're getting all of his big ones out of the way between this,
yes,
this Lord of the Rings, and Star Wars. We're doing them all this
year. Mm-hmm.
Very much the pioneer in the face of motion capture technology, especially when it comes to acting, because he really made it famous with Lord of the Rings. While Jar Jar put it in pulp consciousness, it was really Gollum that really sort of made people question, can you nominate people for, you know, computer-generated or enhanced performances?
Yeah, and we'll be saying this a lot this year. He's pretty good. I mean, the way he does the movements here and the way he moves his face, and he had also done King Kong, what, about 4 or 5 years before this.
Yep.
And so he played a monkey before. You know what? I look at Caesar. I got to be honest, guys. I don't even think of Andy Serkis as I'm watching this. I'm thinking of Caesar the character. And that might be a compliment to the animators as well. You know, I know he's doing all these movements. I know he's jumping up. And I know he's going through and making this the movements that this character makes in this movie. But I'm not thinking of him. And I think that's a compliment to Andy Serkis. I think that's a compliment to the animators.
Completely agree. You know, I love that Serkis works so hard with Weta, with the animators. You know, he's not just somebody coming in, putting the dots mm-hmm. on his face and doing a performance. Like, he's intimately involved in every aspect of it, and I appreciate it. It is such a step up from Gollum, I think. Gollum was amazing, but the lighting and things like that are kind of what help protect a lot of the issues with the way that character is done. I don't see Andy Serkis, but I appreciate that he is bringing emotion, and the animators are bringing emotion out of this ape, this chimpanzee. Like, you get emotion out of the face with the eyes, the eyebrows, the different facial musculature. Like, you get real emotion out of it, and you did not get that at this time.
It's also a bigger challenge, because unlike Gollum, he doesn't speak through the majority of this film. It's all in the physicality.
Yeah, he can't do the Gollum snarls or anything in this. You're absolutely right. He's got to do everything with his face, and he does a remarkable job with it.
It's like his mime work. You know, what he does is he is a performer.
Even though Caesar's been living with him for 3 years, Will kind of keeps him hidden away. You know, he predominantly lives in the house. They don't really go out for walks or anything of that sort. But Will is contemplating whether or not there's been a whole lot of progress on the drug. So we're also being introduced to his father, played by John Lithgow, who anytime he's in a movie will elevate the material. It could be in crap like the Pet Sematary remake, and he's going to give it his all.
Harry and the Hendersons, you know, he's used to a big...
Harry and the fucking Hendersons. I thought he deserved an Oscar nomination for this. I thought he was really, really good. And I think if it wasn't in a pulpy summer blockbuster, I think he would have probably gotten it. I've forgotten how good he is here. He is really good. And you believe that he could be Franco's father in this, you know? I mean, the father-son dynamic is really good between them. It's a sad performance. It's really sad to see because, as Adam mentioned, I mean, if you see someone go through this, it is so emotionally draining for everybody involved, mostly for the person doing it. And yeah, he characterizes that very well.
So while he is attending to his father, Will accidentally leaves the window open, so Caesar escapes. They go outside looking for him, and Caesar gets involved with one of his neighbors, who is not too pleased with seeing a frickin' chimpanzee on his front lawn.
Yeah, this is a ding I want to put on this movie. He is such a caricature. Like, could this guy be any more angry? You know, I thought this was the one time the writing really failed it, where we're getting nothing here except, oh, this guy's going to be the asshole. He's going to be one of the reasons Caesar snaps, you know. And I know it starts the build here, but this guy is just a cliche, and I hated this character.
It seemed like in like a late edition when they realized that they had some holes they needed to plug. So it was just, yeah, it's a caricature, you're right. The one thing, and I notice it right here, because of the placement of this house, where it is, what it looks like. Am I the only one that got Incredible Hulk vibes? That I'm waiting I mean, it's here in the same hills. It's overlooking the Bay Bridge. I'm waiting for Jennifer Connelly to walk out of this house.
Oh, I would have liked that.
Yeah, Jennifer Connelly would have been a better choice than the person we're introduced to momentarily.
All right, we'll fight. Go ahead.
So to get on that plot point, Will decides to take Caesar to a vet played by Freda Pinto, who was towards the end of her 15 minutes of fame thanks to Slumdog Millionaire. I gotta say, I think she's pretty flat in this. I think Jennifer Connelly, yeah, is certainly older than James Franco, but I don't think her and Franco have much chemistry, and I think she's kind of one of the weaker aspects of the movie overall.
All right, let me say this. When we compare it to last week, when we had Mark Wahlberg, who had the sexual charisma of folded towels, and Estella Warren, who couldn't play dead in a country western, I think this is a vast improvement over last week's couple. And you're right. She had her moment. Her big moment was getting nominated for Slumdog Millionaire. And she was in The Immortals from earlier in 2011 as well, which, by the way, also starred Henry Cavill. I think she's fine. I think her and Franco make a pretty good couple. I don't mind her here. I think she's good. And I'm sad that she didn't continue that, because I think she's a welcome presence.
I think she's good. I like her. Actually, I like when we get diverse casting without it being a plot point. I actually appreciate that. I hate that this character is as stupid as you could possibly have a vet be in this situation throughout the course of this film, though. To me, somebody who's working at the San Francisco Zoo, which is world-renowned, just to allow the things that happen throughout the course of this film, you know what? I respect her as an actress. I can't respect that as a doctor.
So they choose to do another time jump where we cut to, I think it's now 5 years, where Caesar is basically a fully mature adult. And they take him on walks at the Redwood Forest. You know, this is big. You know, if you've been to California, this is a notable, you know, the Muir Woods Monument is a pretty big tourist destination.
Took Caesar to Endor.
I do love how, you know, he like scoffs at the German Shepherd that walks by. Like, I also love how everyone they pass is totally okay with seeing a chimpanzee in a sweater on a leash.
Yes.
There's movies where the movie doesn't have to call out how absurd this is.
Yeah, this is really absurd. And there are times when Wyatt is really on his game and does some really remarkable things with this material. And there are times like this when, come on, guys, you couldn't do something about this. You couldn't actually do a little bit of a rewrite to hide how ridiculous this is.
I like that we get to the point that after this interaction with the German Shepherd, that he realizes he's got a collar on his neck. And when Franco's, you know, then trying to get him into the back of the car, he rejects it. And from what I read, this was an Andy Serkis choice. And this is where mocap is so impressive, because you can just do this. You know, Caesar is not going to act like a pet, and he's going to get in the car like the rest of them.
Yeah. I forgot to mention that Will did steal the drug before this flashback. You know, it has seemed to work on his father, although when they cut again to the second time jump, his condition has regressed once again. Tries to get in his Mustang, sees it there, you know, looking out for him, tries to help, but he gets into a scuttle with his neighbor, who gets so aggravated, he literally hits Caesar with a garbage. He pulls a Captain America, takes off a trash can lid, and hits him with it. And this is such a concern for the neighbor that animal control arrives, and Caesar is subsequently taken to an animal shelter. And you know it's not going to be good news when you see Brian Cox walk out of the
Brian Cox from Rupert Wyatt's previous production, The Escapist. He's here. Doesn't make much of an impression here, though. He's kind of in and out of this movie without even really causing a dent.
It looks like he walked right off the set of X-Men 2.
Yes.
Down the beach.
Yeah,
that's true, too.
I think the only time he's not played just a complete slime bag is Super Troopers.
I think you're about right. It depends where you stand on Succession.
I haven't seen it. Heard great things.
Yeah, well, you also haven't watched The Sopranos, so I don't think you're ever getting to Succession. So Caesar is sort of taken in. Will tries to give him some kind of assurance, telling him, you know, it's going to be okay, but they put him in an actual environment with other apes. And speaking of people who walked off the set playing the same character, Tom Felton walked off the Harry Potter set and just played the same character in this.
I would have had no idea who this was unless I had watched those movies with you boys. And here he comes onto this movie. And yeah, he's playing the exact same character. You're absolutely right.
Funny, because it took me a good 5-7 minutes for me to go, man, that guy looks just like Tom Felton, to go, that is Tom Felton. Like, I was like, man, it's amazing. Why did they just get Tom Felton for this role? Because of all the things you hear, you just you never hear about his, you know, co-star, you know, supporting role in this one. I had forgotten all about it. And he's not bad. I'm glad he got something. I wish it was a little more different than what he played. But, you know, you're almost waiting for him just to spit out, you know, that same type of cadence that he would use for Hada and use it for Caesar. He's not bad, but once you realize who it is, you can't help but see Malfoy.
Just because he's abusing the animals and, you know, it's very obvious to make that connection.
Yeah, and his name is one of the obvious references to the previous movies because his name's Dodge Landon, which is the name of the astronauts who flew with Charlton Heston in that first Apes movie. So I don't know what kind of reference that could be when you have the guy be a complete asshole like Felton is here, but there's your reference.
The only thing that would have made it more on the nose is if he was at the, if he had a boa constrictor around his neck.
Yes.
I'm surprised they didn't give him a fake tattoo.
To give him the Slytherin like pendant, they snuck it in on his shirt somewhere, thinking nobody would notice it. But humans are not the only people that treat Caesar like shit, because when he walks in, this movie turns into a prison drama for about 15 minutes, where he's getting tormented by the, you know, the alpha chimpanzee. This turns into like Bad Boys starring Sean Payton, where you think it's gonna be this movie's gonna be like an escape film, and it kind of is
a little bit, yeah,
towards the end. But you know, this is where the movie really becomes about Caesar.
Another human character that I forgot to mention was, you know who I recognize, Matt? I recognize Tyler Labine. He's here. He was another one who had a few minutes of fame. He was in Tucker and Dale versus Evil, and here he is in this movie as one of the handlers. I thought it was funny seeing him. Like, you cannot unmistake his voice. You know his voice right away. Pretty funny seeing him in this movie.
But yeah, he's got Michael Wincott syndrome of you realize has that voice anywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
So from here, Franco and Pinto kind of take a back seat, which is totally okay because the movie knows that you're not here to see them anymore for the most part. But Caesar, on the inside, makes friends with Maurice, who is one of the orangutans, who can also, you know, you could argue it's convenient. He knows sign language, but, you know, it's fine.
I like how all these monkeys, they all have the different classes like we've seen previous. You know, Adam's pointed that out numerous times where they do a good job of classifying the apes in all of these movies, and they do it here as well.
But Caesar learns how to unlock the cage, and he also, thanks to one of the gorillas, so we got a gorilla, a chimp, and a orangutan, so we got the three class systems as you alluded to, and Caesar, to use the prison analogy, takes over the yard. He becomes the alpha.
It does, like, it feels, I mean, natural, run a sci-fi fantasy film, but this development feels proper for this film here. You know, it really does, and it shows the rise of not just Caesar, but an evolution that we didn't get in those other five of how the apes become what they are. You know, you can see the steps. Well, we can see the steps, even though the vet who was living there for 5 years obviously didn't see the evolution in Caesar, but we could see the evolution here as we're watching the film. And I think it's nice to see that way because we haven't gotten that before.
It was sort of seeing that, you know, there is a obvious connection where they reignite the drug testing where they convert it to a gas form. They call it the ALS-113 because Will says that, you know, it can improve intelligence. But again, the quote unquote villains in this movie are pretty simplistic. Like, even his boss is kind of just about money.
They almost forgot that there needs to be villainy in this because he's not bad, but then they make sure that he drops the line, "You're in this for science, I'm in it for money."
Yeah.
You know, it's
yeah,
almost
that's
there
where I
just
yeah.
to make sure that we get that there's bad guys.
Yeah, this is where it kind of he's the character that feels like right out of the Bay Transformers films. He might as well be Patrick Dempsey from that third one. Will takes the drug home for his father in the guise of using it for treatment, but his father declines, saying that, you know, I'm okay with dying. So this will get you.
This is heartbreaking.
You know, this is the thing I was not expecting because the marketing really doesn't tell you this is the genesis of the apes. You know, it's I like the evolutionary thing of the as the this drug is meant to increase human intelligence, but it winds up what was meant to help us ultimately takes us off the top of the food chain.
It's a change. This film is not occupied anywhere with weapons and war until the very, very end, slightly. You know, this completely goes a different way, and it's going to still have a reason or find a reason of why humans get wiped out the way that we do. So it's starting to go down that route. And I didn't remember such a drastic change, but I didn't know about, you know, nuclear war in the original series. So it's nice to put their own stamp on it, do it differently. And I see the route we're going to go down, because this is also where we start to get every one of these have got a big morality speech that it's giving. And this is genetic testing, animal testing, mm-hmm. and, you know, the medicinal manipulation that we do on humans.
Yeah, big pharma, you know. Yep. Because if you remember, like,
yeah, which was
a topic of conversation around this time.
I was just about ready to say that. Yeah. This was a huge topic around that time. You know, stem cell research, all of that. Big time topics.
We were getting stuff like swine flu and SARS and that kind of stuff. Like, yeah. You know, take COVID out of it because fuck your political sides of that. But there were frequent infections that we were getting from overseas, and this kind of taps into that as well.
Yeah, bird flu, there was all kinds of...
Yep.
And, you know, like, pandemic films were starting, which is what this movie becomes. Contagion had come out, like, a year before this, I think.
Well, watch Contagion now, and that is... Oh, God. That's a documentary.
Yeah, that movie, like, the only thing that's missing for that movie is people stealing toilet paper.
Amazing. I never watched that until last year. It's amazing how right that movie gets it.
Yeah. Will tells them that I'm not crazy about this, and he quits his job, but not before... They start doing trials. They try to test it on one of the monkeys. And the handler from Tucker and Dale vs. Evil is Patient Zero. So this is the guy that destroys humanity.
Figures.
But, you know, he's trying to tell Will, runs to his house saying, you know, they're testing it, but he sneezes on the neighbor, and we find him dead. So this is where we're starting to see that, yeah, it's ultimately this contagion is going to be what wipes out humanity, not necessarily a nuclear bomb, which I like. I think this is in the same way that Batman Begins made fear toxin plausible. I like this change a lot.
Yeah, I like it too. I like the fact that we're not having, of course, there's always the fear of nuclear bombs, but back in the 70s, it was a huge, huge, huge fear, to the point where in the 70s and 80s, as me and Adam mentioned, they were making us get under the desk to shield ourselves from a nuclear blast, because yeah, that would be what would happen. That would be what would protect us in a nuclear blast, is getting under the desk. We're not doing that as much in 2011. And so I like this change. I like the fact that we are, as you guys just mentioned, we are tapping into something that was a huge topic of conversation, you know, and then the movie causes these discussions because it's under the guise of being a popcorn action flick. It's also, again, having something to say. How many times have we said that in this retrospective? And when done right, that can be very, very good. And I'm having a really good time watching this movie at this point.
And now the movie sort of kicks into what you're expecting with this title, where Will tries to go back and take Caesar back home, but Caesar says, no, I'm going to stay. And he steals the drugs, which are conveniently kept in the refrigerator, and he uses it to make all the other apes smarter. And he Avada Kedavra's Malfoy with an electrical current, you know, inadvertent. Like, he didn't try to murder him, but it just sort of happened. You know, it's sort of accidental. And the apes are all freed, and they start to run rampant. Not only do they free the apes that are here in captivity, they go to the San Francisco Zoo and take them all out. So I'm pretty sure Michael Crichton wrote a book about this, if I'm not mistaken.
Pretty sure.
Oh, I've been to that zoo, and yes, they are very like that. You pull down that one section of fence, and all the monkeys are getting loose. Oh, I love Monkey Island at the zoo.
Yeah, well, you're not going to love it in the context of this movie, because these apes are pretty formidable. They manage to, you know, this is where the Conquest homages are really coming in, because there's a police blockade.
Yes, yep. I thought of that.
So I'm going to say, for all the things that I appreciate, San Bruno, which is where they say this ape sanctuary is about 10 miles south of San Francisco proper. San Francisco Zoo is in Daly City, which is all the way against the Pacific Ocean, all the way on the west coast. And downtown San Francisco is all the way on the northern waterfront of San Francisco. This is a big-ass area if you know San Francisco whatsoever. And I'm laughing at it. It doesn't matter in the course of the film, but it just makes me chuckle when they can't get geography.
Yeah, this bothers people in the same way that, like, New York City will bother certain people, depending on the movie you're watching, like Die Hard 3, where I'm like, there's no way you can get from X to F in that amount of time. But the apes fight their way across the blockade, because they're trying to get into the Redwood Forest. So they're not even trying to take over. They're just trying to get their own space.
Yeah. They're just trying to go home. one of the little things here, and I'd never realized this, never thought of it, and it, the context of these five films are so important. Caesar repeatedly gets these apes to stop from killing. From the moment he says no, and that word has meaning because we heard how much no mattered to the apes in those previous films. In the ape no kill ape, but Caesar is against killing, and he continuously stops the apes from killing humans here.
Yeah, I noticed that as well, and I definitely would not have noticed that if I hadn't gone through the series with you guys.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I don't want to call them subtleties, because, you know, if you're even a casual fan of the Planet of the Apes, you'll get the references, but I think they're presented very well. Because this could have been a very different movie with those references.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Especially because the word no was kind of ruined by Revenge of the Sith. So having Caesar shout no could have been a disastrous scene.
Yep.
People could have laughed at that if it was done wrong.
When it was obvious he was going to speak, I was ready for a Jurassic Park 3 moment. That's what I thought. That's a reaction I was preparing myself for. So I was glad he didn't go that way.
God damn, people, Star Wars fans do not think of Revenge of the Sith as much as you bring it up on this podcast, Matt.
Why not do it? The most infamous scene from the movie.
Lord.
One of the apes sacrifices themselves to, you know, save Caesar. They take down the helicopter with Will's boss inside. So, yeah, they do have some blood on their hands, but, you know, this sort of ties into the next movie. They do some stuff with Koba in the next one, which we'll talk about. But, you know, the apes don't storm City Hall and try to take over. They make their way to the forest, and Will tells Caesar that, you know, this is just the beginning. Like, they're going to hunt you down. And he says, come home. But Caesar tells him, you know, I am home. I'm going to leave my people. And they sort of, you know, it's kind of like E.T. where he says goodbye to them. In a lot of ways. I'm not saying that to be facetious. It kind of plays like that.
Yeah, it's a strange ending, and it's emotional, you know, of a father-son type of thing where him going away with the son becoming more powerful than the father and being more learned and stronger and finding his own kind. It could go a lot of different ways that would maybe be a little more saccharine, but it would not feel in place for this film. And even this thing ending on a triumphant note, it feels a little weird, but it feels right.
Yeah, this is a scene that, if played wrong, could have gone very wrong. The way it's played by Andy Serkis and James Franco here is fantastic. I do really, really enjoy the way these two are separated, because you're right, Adam. The son has now become more powerful than the father. So the son has said that he is now integrated and he doesn't need him anymore, pretty much. And that is a heartbreaking thing when your kids get to be teenagers and they say, all right, mom and dad, I want to go to college, or I want to go live my life. I don't need you anymore. Like, my fiance is going through that with her daughter. Like, her daughter's in the Air Force, and it's a whole feeling of helplessness that James Franco's feeling here. And not to mention the fact that his father has passed away as well. Everything he has done has gone for naught, because now everything is gone. And it's very powerful. It's stuff that, in the context of this film, works, and in the context of life, resonates very well.
Will doesn't fight him on it, and he leaves, and the apes begin to start their, you know, new life, knowing full well that there is something to come. But the movie's not over yet, because, yeah, this is triumphant for the apes, but the movie can't end on a good note if you know the property that this series is rebooting, because we see his neighbor, who is a pilot, which is established, shows up at the airport, coughs up blood, and we realize that he is going to spread the virus across the planet and wipe us out. So, you know, this is a horror movie ending.
I did not remember this ending whatsoever. And to me, it makes me think that maybe we saw it at the drive-in, because we would have done that around that time because of the age of the kids, and we would have been rushing out. But I did not remember. It's not really post-credit. It's like after the first five credits or after the end title card, this pops back up really quick. But, oh, man, this really does set up this just epidemic, pandemic moment that we learn is going to wipe us all out.
Yeah, I didn't remember this as well. Like, this took me completely by surprise.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea that, you know, we were on the final episode of the first season of 24, where we see the president have some kind of flu or something that's going to be the context of the next season. And, you know, and Matt, you didn't mention, you know, we talked about how the apes roamed around San Francisco and whatnot, but we didn't really talk about the Golden Gate Bridge scene, which I think is heads and shoulders above the X-Men Golden Gate Bridge scene.
Yeah, and it's suddenly night.
Exactly. But not only that, there's a whole bunch of good things that go on here. The way these apes jump on these cars and things on this bridge is just so well done. And as somebody who's been on that bridge many, 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 many times, it was something to see. To see these apes take this over, it's kind of frightening to see. I thought the scene on the bridge was very well done. It was something that the movie was built around. I remember there was a lot of hype around this scene. Watching it 13 years later, I think it holds up pretty well.
It's also really impressive to see when you realize the budget of this film. Like, it looks clean, even this long later. Some of the other stuff, you're like, you know, it's not perfect, but it's amazing how these effects hold up better now, 13 years later, 14 years before, you know, when it was made, than some effects work does that are just a few years old. Marble.
You compare this to Quantumania, and it's laughable. Among other things. But yeah, I like that also that scene is not them just going around mass slaughter, but it's still showing you that the apes are more than capable of taking us down. To what extent, you know, we'll have to talk about the future of this franchise, but that's how the movie ends. You know, this does not end on a good note by any stretch, but also, like I said, it can't given the context of this franchise.
And I was going to say, you know, if I think that was a big part of my review, if I remember correctly, was, God damn, why would you end this movie on that sour of a note? But in watching all these movies with you guys, every single one of these fucking movies ends on a sour note. So it's just keeping up with tradition. And that's exactly what it's doing here.
Yeah, and tradition concludes because the movie ends. And we've talked about now 7 of these Planet of the Apes movies. 10 years removed from Tim Burton's film, I imagine our reviews are going to be a bit more favorable, but who knows. So, Garrett, on a scale of 1 to 10, what do you give Rise of the Planet of the Apes?
Wow, going to me first, huh? You know, I tried my damnedest. I tried, after watching this movie, pulling up my review to see if what I had written then, if I thought any of that today. Unfortunately, the site I wrote it for is no longer in existence, and I did not take it and save it to my letterbox, so that review's gone forever. But I remember the general idea of it being, you know, it's good, but it's not great. I think this movie is on the cusp of being great. I'm not going to call it great. I think there are performances here that are very good. A lot of them so surprising. James Franco surprised me. And some that are not so surprising. John Lithgow is good every single time. But here he's heartbreaking. But let's face it. The stars of this movie are the apes. The star of this movie is Andy Serkis. The star of this movie is Weta Digital. And for the most part, all of those come to play. I think the effects hold up decently well. And the biggest compliment I can pay it is I never thought once about the making as I was watching this. Like, as they were roaming around, I believed all of them were actual apes. You know, when you're on film, when you go on film sets and things and you watch a movie, it doesn't escape your mind how much you think, okay, well, how was this made? How was that made? Because I've seen that process, but I didn't think about that once while watching this. I think in the grand scheme of things, it's much better than I remembered. It's still not great though. I want to go ahead and give it a 7. Very watchable, very good popcorn film with a lot of powerful messages woven within it. And it sets you up very well for what we're going to see next week, which I hear is perhaps the best of the series. So I'll go 7 out of 10 for Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
All right, so we got a 7. Good start. Adam, where do you stand?
Coming back into this film, I was prepared to like it more than, you know, obviously Tim Burton's film, which kind of panned, but I didn't know if I'd get the response that I got from those original films, seeing those for the first time. I was surprised how much the longer I went into this film, I kept thinking to myself, this is really good. This does have something to say. It has something different to say, but it has something to say. And between that, between the performances, between the amazing motion capture and emotion capture, this film is a really good watch. It doesn't have the stunt casting moves that Tim Burton did with certain characters. James Franco probably plays exactly the role that he needs to play in this film. He's competent. He does a decent job, but he doesn't detract from it. As, you know, we've all kind of mentioned just how great John Lithgow was. And even Brian Cox, you know, he's slimy, but at least he doesn't take over the parts that he's in. This film feels like a natural evolution of the Apes franchise, made for today, made with the current political climate that was in those times and the issues that were being talked about in the press, which is what the original apes were. I know why I didn't continue the franchise after this film, but I was surprised how much, going back to this, I found it a worthy watch, a good watch. I started it with my wife sitting right next to me. She was doing some work on the couch, and, you know, halfway through, she just turned and stopped her work and was watching it with me as well, and we got back into that, watching it like we did 10 years ago, 13 years ago. I have the exact same score as Garrett. It's a 7. I think this is a really good watch. I think it's a more than competent kickoff for a franchise. I don't know if they planned it for a franchise initially. I think they had hoped. But even if it was a one and done, it would stand alone pretty well. And I'm now very excited to see what I'm going to get for the next few films. But, yeah, strong 7 on 10.
I think a lot of times, whether or not you're anticipating or expecting a movie is going to affect your score. At the time, I did think this was a pleasant surprise. And I will say, I think it's actually gotten a little bit better with age. Part of it's because it has aged very well when you look at the effects, and with COVID, certainly, there's some parallels that you can draw from that make it a bit more of a stark reality than science fiction. The thing I really appreciate about this movie is it's under 2 hours. Thank God. And I don't feel like this movie was fighting to get to 90 minutes. It had a story to tell, had a message, it had some thought and genuine care into how you reboot this property while also not fully getting you to the status quo you would expect. There is still room to get us to where humans are mute creatures and apes have built civilization. This doesn't feel like a movie that, okay, we got to wrap this up and get... Not to harken to Star Wars again, but it's not the ending of Revenge of the Sith where it's like, all right, we got 5 minutes, we got to tie every single thing in together just to put all of our ducks in a row. No, they left it open, but also it's one of those things to where if they didn't make other ones, I wouldn't feel dissatisfied. Like, I would look at this as a prequel and you just fill in the blanks. I do think some of the characters are pretty underwritten, mostly the antagonist type of roles, but because of how much I appreciated the work that and the thought that went into this, I don't think it's a great movie, and I don't think in the reboot pantheon, I don't put this on the pantheon of Batman Begins or Casino Royale. I think those are just impeccable pieces of reboots. This is the next step down, but still pretty damn good. Pleasant surprise, to be sure. And at the time, I think this was the surprise blockbuster of the summer. So I'm going to, surprisingly, I have the same score written down as both of you. I'm going to give this a 7 as well. But where do we go from here? Well, as I mentioned, the director said, yeah, we got some places we can take this. We left on some notes to potentially explore. And they waited less than a year to announce a sequel.
Yeah. I was really curious about the development of this. And it's directed by somebody who the three of us have spoken about before, Mr. Matt Reeves. He just did The Batman. And here he was coming off a very good, I thought, remake of Let the Right One In called Let Me In. And he was the one tapped to do this. And for the life of me, I don't remember why, I never did see next week's movie, and I have heard great things about it. Like I said, I've heard it is the best of the series, so I'm actually really looking forward to watching next week's film.
I am as well. I remember it being announced, I remember seeing a trailer, and I remember them going, well, it's this, it's the apes, there's no James Franco, there's no this, and I went, well, wait a minute, this isn't a sequel, this is, I don't know what this is, and I'm not going to bother. And I just didn't give it a second thought. It was more just apathy than anything else. But yeah, I'm really excited to delve into it. I don't think I realized Matt Reeves did this. So you gotta realize at that point I had kids that are about the age that Matt's are now. It's really hard to get to the theater to do things. So yeah, I can't wait to delve into this next generation of apes.
At the very least, boys, it does feel good to actually watch and review real movies again after the string of Night Shift that we just did.
Says the guy who forced us to watch all that bullshit. Buyer's remorse much? I was more anticipatory of this one than I was of Rise, just because I had the pleasant surprise thing and they were building off it. I was curious about the 10-year time jump that they had said they were doing, and I knew that, you know, Franco was not coming back, so there were going to be some big changes. I'll save my thoughts on Matt Reeves when we get to that movie. He had just done the Let the Right One In remake, and he had done Cloverfield. You know, this is far removed from when he would get Batman, but this movie that we'll talk about next week is kind of why people were excited that he got Batman, even though he'll be doing the next two that we talk about. But 2014, you know, unlike 2011, it was a much better summer when you look at totality. So it seemed like, you know, the blockbusters were hitting on a much more at a higher rate of success than they had previously. So that certainly gave me some goodwill. So, you know, I think it'll be a good conversation, certainly, but we'll see if the first-time viewers are the ones who get something out of it. And Garrett's not one who typically masks his feelings about hype and whether or not something hits it or not. So we'll see. We'll see how that goes. But till next week, when we talk about Dawn, the Planet of the Apes, take your stick and paws off me, you damn dirty podcast. Thank you, guys.
Let me make a last appeal to your reason before we inflict more of this on you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast.
Thank you.
Join us next week for an entirely new review.
Tell me something, McDonald. Can we make the future what we wish?
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Aldo was right. War has come.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
So many questions I want to ask.
And if you enjoyed this review, please head on over to percolatedmedia.net or search your podcast platform of choice to access our Percolated Media archives and hear our reviews of other franchises like Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Pirates of the Caribbean, the films adapted from the published works of Stephen King, Top Gun, the DC Universe featuring Batman, the Superman DC Universe, and so many more.
And so, Mandemus, we must be patient and wait.
The Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Do they look like just apes to you?
Given the power to alter the future, have we the right to use it?
The Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast is edited by Garrett.
I'll abide by that finding.
Just hear what I have to say.
The Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
You just imagine that he hurt you.
For the moment, we should follow their example.
The Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast is for review and discussion, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
In one of the countless billions of galaxies in the universe lies a medium-sized star, and one of its satellites, a green and insignificant planet, is now dead.
Hey, this looks like it's updated and modern, and it's set where I live here in the San Francisco area. My wife at the time who, you know, or sorry, at the my wife, not at the time.
Still, I was going to say, wait a second here.
Yeah, okay, she didn't hear me. You know, it is such a step up from Gollum. I think Gollum was amazing, but the lighting and things like that are kind of what help protect a lot of the issues with the way that character is done. I've never seen King Kong, the modern one, so I can't speak to that. I watched about 20 minutes, and we still hadn't gotten an ape. I turned it off.
Yeah, he said 20 minutes, but it was really 4 hours.
Yeah, I looked at the runtime and went, oh, damn, nope.
I really like that movie. We'd have to do that one day.
I'll get to it eventually, I promise. She's better than Estella Warren, better looking, better actress.
I think both of those points are debatable. Although, don't take my word for it.
Oh my god, dude. Are you serious?
She's better than Estella.
Well, I mean, I know you wouldn't know.
That's like saying, you know, the sky is blue.
I know you're not one to judge a woman's looks, but as two heterosexual males on the other end of this call, I'm going to say I do think she is she's not as good looking as Estelle Warren. I'll say that.
I just have a weakness for blondes. I don't know why.
See, and I'm not a fan. So
yeah, I know. You got the redhead. You got the redhead. ALZRED. But till next week, when we talk about Dawn, the Planet of the Apes, take your stick and paws off me, you damn dirty podcast. Thank you, guys.
I can't believe you forgot to mention that line is in this movie.
Yeah, that was the one thing I forgot to mention. That's the one bad reference.
And that was the one where I went, I get you have to do it, but... Well, shoot, and Charlton Heston was on TV in the background.
Yeah, that's true. God damn it. Nice outline, Matt. You forgot to include that one.